Peter Royce first started on Red Eye in 1983. He operated the soundboard, and he produced stories for the show for about 6 months until he was hired as a staff member at the station. While he was on staff, he started hosting, not on Red Eye, but on a half-hour public affairs show called The Rational. At that time, The Rational aired every evening from 6 to 6:30 p.m. Peter would host the Friday night show right at the end of a very busy week at work. He used to grab his notes for his interviews and run into the studio at the last minute, but still managed to be interested and engaged in the interviews. After he left his staff position at the station, Peter rejoined Red Eye. He wasn't in a hurry to start hosting again, preferring to do the behind-the-scenes work that goes into putting on a weekly radio show. But happily, we managed to persuade him to get back on air, and his voice was heard on Red Eye for many years. He continued as a regular host right up until a year before his death, when his worsening health prevented him from coming down to the station. This morning, we're going to play excerpts from some of the interviews Peter did over the past 6 years. We're going to start with a critical examination he did of the appeal of what is known as the 9/11 truth movement and of conspiracy theories in general. Peter was well aware that this was a controversial subject among Red Eye listeners, but he wanted to get another point of view across. And so he spoke with Michael Shermer of the Skeptic Society in March 2003.
You've probably heard the story from a friend or acquaintance. The September 11th World Trade Center attacks were planned and executed from within the US government. Maybe yours was one of the 10 million downloads of the internet film Loose Change that also maintains that 9/11 was an inside job, and they provide mounds of evidence to make a case for a massive conspiracy to fool the public. Conspiracy theories, like those surrounding 9/11, are not new. Others have circulated about the moon landing and the death of Princess Diana. Michael Shermer is the founder of the US-based Skeptic Society and editor of their magazine, The Skeptic. He's joined me by phone from California to talk about conspiracy theories. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
The message we hear with 9/11 is that we've just got to look at the evidence and we will understand that it must have been a conspiracy. What sort of evidence is given?
It's mainly stringing together a bunch of factoids, no one of which holds any water at all, but when put together in a conspiratorial pattern, makes it seem like there might be something nefarious at work. And this is just classic pattern-seeking behavior, you know, connecting the dots. It's all false positives. The connections aren't really there. First, we should clarify, of course, there was a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy by Al-Qaeda and the 19 operatives and whoever was behind them. That's a given. But what is claimed is that the Bush administration on some level had some involvement as well. And so that's where the facts begin to break down. So if you take, for example, this Internet movie, this whole thing, by the way, is an Internet-driven urban legend, myth, whatever, conspiracy theory. It's based on this film called Loose Change, where it's very compelling to see it kind of strung along from start to finish, and you get to the end and you think, oh my God, if only like half of this is right, this is, you know, huge. But then I went and started checking the facts, and it, not only is it not half right, there's nothing right in it. Not a single fact was correct. And so it's all just a tissue of lies, and strung together, it looks compelling, but in fact there's nothing there.
So what's wrong with the evidence then put forward in the film?
Well, I mean, I guess it just depends which claim we want to look at. If you start off with something like why the Twin Towers fell. And so they make a claim like, well, steel melts at 2,700 degrees and jet fuel burns at 1,500 degrees. So clearly the plane impact and the burning of the jet fuel could not have melted the steel, and therefore the buildings could not have fallen due to the impact. Well, this is wrong on multiple levels. First of all, you don't have to completely melt the steel in order to weaken it enough to collapse. You only have to weaken it maybe 50%, which 1,500 degrees will easily do. And that's enough to cause the steel to sag, to cause the force or pressure on the joint bolts holding the steel crossbars to the sides of the buildings to break and snap and start the pancaking effect.
Is there some sort of misuse or misunderstanding of the actual concept of evidence itself?
It's a misunderstanding of two things, both data and theory, the evidence and how it's interpreted. So the way we prove large events like that is through a convergence of evidence from a series of independent lines of inquiry. So let's drop 9/11 for a second and just talk about like how we know the Holocaust happened. The Holocaust deniers say, oh, look at this little factoid or that factoid. Those are anomalies, not explained. Therefore, the whole thing didn't happen. Well, wait a minute. the evidence that the Holocaust happened was never dependent on those one or two little anomalous factoids that you think you found. It's proven by tens of thousands of bits of data from 10,000 places, from millions of people, all converging independently of one another to this conclusion that the Holocaust happened. And it's the same thing how we know evolution happened. Creationists are fond of saying, oh, just show me one transitional fossil. And they think, you know, that if they have one tiny factoid fossil that doesn't seem to fit, that takes down the whole edifice. Well, evolution was never proved in the first place by that one little fossil. So whether you think you can debunk that fossil or not is meaningless to the overall theory. So it's a misinterpretation. I call it the fossil fallacy, in fact, that one fossil proves evolution, one piece of evidence proves the Holocaust, one factoid proves or disproves 9/11. That's not how evidence works at all.
Are there elements that are common to most conspiracy theories or things we call conspiracy theories?
Yes, it's that it's a search for simpler explanations, so almost on Occam's razor, that, you know, let's just reduce the complexity and have just a single simple explanation. So and then there's always this again, it's sort of a misuse of the facts, this fossil fallacy that if you could just find one or two anomalies, that that somehow that brings the whole edifice down. And also that that a single theory should be able to explain every single fact. And if it can't, then the whole thing is false. Well, that's not true. That's just a complete misunderstanding of how things are explained. No theory in science, for example, explains every single fact, every anomaly, everything about the world. It's just the best approximation. What's the best model or theory we have to explain the set of data, given the fact that no theory is going to explain everything? So there's always this residue problem, the residue of unexplained anomalies. They're always there, and we just continue to work on them, but you still accept the prevailing model.
So then, given all that, how do conspiracy theorists argue their case so successfully with so many people in this particular instance, for sure?
Well, I think part of it is that there is a distrust of the Bush administration in general because the war has gone so badly. So that primes people for thinking, yeah, they're up to something, all that Halliburton and Cheney and Rumsfeld and all those guys are in cahoots. And, you know, Americans are sort of naturally skeptical of politics anyway, which is a good thing because, you know, things there are conspiracies that do happen in government circles, no doubt. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of behind-the-scenes things that none of us know about. But that's, of course, different from proving that this particular one actually happened. And so I think people are primed for it in the specific case here. But in general, the idea that a complex, chaotic world is not actually really almost inexplicable, almost insoluble, it's so complex. And in fact, there's just 12 guys living in London that control the world, the Illuminati, or it's just this small group of Bush operatives, the people that went to Yale and they belong to that Skull and Crossbones Society, or the Rockefellers, or the Rothschilds, or the Da Vinci Code, or, you know, you name it, that there's some really simple explanation that explains all the myriad complexities of history in this very simple little thing, and I can wrap my mind around it. And then finally, there's this sort of titillating reinforcement you get that, you figured it out, that you have an inside track on the secrets of the universe and the world and history, and nobody else has it, and by God, it's not this huge complex thing, it's this very simple thing, and I got it figured out. So that's kind of reinforcing. It makes people feel like they're not quite so helpless, a cog in the giant machine, you know, just another nobody, but wow, in fact, I have inside information.
Yes, I think that from the other side of the story, conspiracy theories are very attractive. I'm wondering whether they address some sort of basic human need.
Oh, the other thing is cognitive dissonance, too. There should be matching causes for the effects that you see. That is, there's something cognitively dissonant about Kennedy being assassinated by a complete nobody, a lone nut, Lee Harvey Oswald. But the fact is, he did it. He did it by himself. All the evidence points to it. None of the conspiracy theories hold up. And there's something disconcerting about that the greatest, most powerful man in the Western world is taken out by some nobody, a complete loser living in the nooks and crannies of society. But if you stop and think about it for just a moment, that is precisely how it could happen. It's the only way it could happen, because in a free democratic society, it is possible for a nobody to disappear into the nooks and crannies and then just suddenly do his thing. Exactly in the same way that Jack Ruby got into the room there and shot Lee Harvey Oswald a couple of days later. But the dissonance there is that a great man must be brought down by a great conspiracy. So no, it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. It was the FBI and the CIA and Castro and the Russians and the KGB and the Mafia, and you know, all that seems to balance the scale. Great man Kennedy brought down by great conspiracy X. And the same thing, you saw this with Princess Di back when she was killed in the car accident. I mean, what could be more mundane than a car accident, right? You know, speeding, drunk driving, no seatbelts. You have the perfect formula for, you know, death by automobile. It happens, what, 50,000 people a year are killed in American highways due to drunk driving, no seatbelts, and speeding. That's the standard formula. And nobody blinks an eye when they read, you know, somebody was killed in a drunk driving accident. Oh, yeah, yet another one. But when it's Princess Di, it's like, oh, wait a minute. This is a great, beautiful, powerful person. She's important. She can't have been brought down by this mundane explanation. There must be something behind it. And off we go in search of patterns.
Is there a way of somehow sort of vaccinating ourselves so that we're not so vulnerable to catching one of these sort of conspiracy viruses?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's hard. It's that's the big question, of course. Everybody in skepticism and science education and education in general is concerned about critical thinking studies. This is the whole point. How can we get people to train their minds? And the fact is, it does work. Just being exposed to other ideas, to good explanations. I mean, short of a good explanation, the mind just accepts any default explanation that it hears, as opposed to no explanation. Because we have most people have a low tolerance for ambiguity and uncertainty. We like to have some explanation. So without groups like the skeptics, who are here to provide that other explanation, and there's lots of other groups as well that do this, you know, people will just accept whatever they hear on TV or the news or especially the internet. And so our job is really, it's just education to say, no, wait a minute, let's consider that evidence. Let's look at this other idea. We have to, you know, fuel good ideas to drive out the bad ideas.
Well, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with me this morning.
No, you're welcome.
I've been talking with Michael Shermer. Michael Shermer is the founder of the Skeptic Society and editor of the Skeptic magazine.
And you're listening to a special tribute to longtime host and Red Eye Collective member Peter Royce. At a memorial for Peter last Sunday evening, people learned about the first of his many successes at community organizing. He was a student at Reading University in the mid-70s and was appalled at the standard of food available in the school cafeteria. He was determined to do something about it. So he helped create and run a food distribution system to get whole foods to students. The interview you're about to hear was one he set up about a current project in the Lower Mainland that must have reminded Peter of his earlier efforts.
A new co-op in Vancouver has just started business to try and create a sustainable way of connecting local organic food producers with buyers in Vancouver. It's not a regular food co-op selling food without profit, nor is it a farmer's market just selling local produce. Neighbours Organic Weekly Buying Clubs, or NOW-BC, is a food distribution system that doesn't rely on commercial storefronts, but does help build community amongst those who use it. Joanna Michael is the outreach coordinator of NOW-BC, and she's joined me to talk about it. Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning, Peter.
So, tell me, how does the system work?
What happens is our participants go online and order their food once a week. You can select specific items, which produce you want, bulk foods, milk, eggs, and then once a week we deliver to neighborhoods all over Greater Vancouver. We deliver to a member's home, and each of these members' homes are called depots. The nearby neighbors come to that member's home and pick up their food every week.
So, you know, when you talk about one of these depots at someone's home, how many members would be attached to one depot?
Well, a good size depot is 10 to 15 people, because each participant doesn't have to order every week. So that way it sort of guarantees that you get a decent number of orders every week coming to your house, and makes it worth a delivery, and offers a little bit of community visiting.
Like, do they need to have a porch or a lock-up area or something like that? How does it not get stolen or get wet?
Ideally, it's a front porch or a back porch or a carport, or for basement suites, under the deck or something like that, a covered lit area where people can pick up their food and it doesn't get drenched even in the middle of winter. And as far as stealing food, if that's a problem, people have been known to set up a box that they put a padlock on or something to that effect. Though for the most part, it's not a problem. It's on someone's front porch and it's too close to really be grabbed, and it's picked up pretty quick. So
yeah. So, okay, so we've got these depots, these clubs with these club hosts that have their porch or their garage or whatever that's being used. Now, how many of those depots are there? Like, you've only just started up again, I understand. So how many are there going now?
We have 18 going on 19, 20, and 21.
Okay.
We have new people interested in hosting a depot every few days. It's we can't start them fast enough, it seems.
Oh, well, that's fantastic that you're really in a growth phase at the moment.
It's great. It's great. People are really keen on NOW-BC at this point.
Okay, so that's the consumer end of it. Okay, so what about the producers? Where does the food come from?
Our focus is local foods from local farms and processors. We want to support community, but we really want to support sustainable foods.
So these are like Valley Organic Farmers?
Glen Valley is one of our major suppliers. Mm. We also carry Anita's Flour and oats and things like that.
How does the food then get from the farms to the clubs, the people's balconies and porches?
It's a little bit of a mix of things. Some of the farmers deliver to us to a central location, where then we truck the food out to each neighborhood.
Okay.
Other people we pick up from. This week we're about to carry Aphrodite's organic pies, and we'll pick up from them.
I suddenly got a pang of hunger there. I don't know what was going on. So now, you've said that it's part of a larger village concept. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Well, we're closely affiliated with Village Vancouver. Our focus on community building really plays into that, getting neighbors to know each other, cooperate with each other, is really important to us.
So what are the benefits, environmental and otherwise, to having a system like this?
Well, eating locally is super important to reducing our carbon footprints. If you consider how far your food travels to get from farm to plate, it's incredible. It's an incredible amount of infrastructure, money, gasoline that can get it there from out of country, from California, from overseas, and food is often fresher, tastier, and way less of an ecological nightmare to get to you if you simply buy in British Columbia.
So reduction of the ecological footprint basically is the big thing, and a way of providing local organic food to people here.
Yes, absolutely.
So now the current initiative grew out of earlier efforts. And I suppose I'm interested in terms of, like, it sounds like you're in this great growth phase at the moment. What went wrong last time that you've somehow changed now?
Well, essentially, last time it was operator burnout. It was an informally organized group that boiled down to really one person doing everything. And at the end of the day, we didn't reach a sustainable enough size to support our infrastructure in a quick enough time frame. So in the spring, we shut down. Then there was a huge outcry. People couldn't see this food go. They couldn't see this distribution network disappearing. And since there's been a huge rally, our mail list has grown by 3 times, and we started back up again as a cooperative. We have a board of directors. We have 60-something shareholders now. We'll be able to ensure we have a community of people making this work.
Do you think are there other advantages to being a co-op that you've noticed so far, or do you hope to notice?
Well, for the most part, it just speaks to everything we're about. It's about community efforts and cooperating with one another.
So now you've mentioned that people can participate and buy food without becoming a shareholder. But can you tell us what would be involved, you know, on both sides of that, either to just buy food or to buy food mm-hmm. as a shareholder, to become a shareholder member or whatever?
We're interested in supplying local foods to everyone. The advantages of being a member are that, one, you're investing in a local, ecologically friendly organization. You're helping to support that and build our infrastructure. You're also eligible for patronage refunds and dividends that will be decided upon annually when we get to that point. And, of course, we really want shareholders, especially the real keeners and regular buyers, so that we have their input, that they can come to our AGMs, that they can talk to us about issues, that they can vote on major co-op issues and elect our board of directors. We really need their input so that we are we're supplying what people need.
So, okay, let's say I'm living in a Vancouver neighborhood. I'm interested in starting to get some sort of connection to what you're doing. How would I go about getting involved?
Go to nowbc.ca and look at our list of delivery depots. Find a club host, try it out, and go from there.
Would I just contact the club host myself?
You would. You can contact myself, Joanna Michael, and I can help you get started anytime. Though a lot of people, they go online, they find a club host in their area, their emails are all posted, drop them an email, let them know you're interested, they'll send you back information on where to pick up. You place an order that week and go join the food pickup party.
Okay, that's great. I think I'm getting a bit more of a picture of it. Well, thanks very much for coming in and explaining it to me. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
Peter Royce spoke with Joanna Michael in October last year. Joanna Michael is coordinator of Neighbors Organic Weekly Buying Clubs, or simply Now BC. When Peter was at university, he studied horticultural botany. He didn't finish his degree because he was frustrated with the world of academia, but he maintained his interest in botany, genetics, and biology throughout his life. In early 2007, he came across a report about the dangers of synthetic biology, and he set up the interview we're going to hear next.
Synthetic biology, or synbio, is the design and construction of new biological parts, devices, and systems that don't exist in the natural world. Symbios emerged from a confluence of new developments in our ability to manipulate atoms, genes, bits of information, and neurons. Using desktop DNA synthesizers or mail-order DNA bought via the internet, the do-it-yourself assembly of synthetic genes and genomes is now possible almost anywhere in the world. According to one synthetic biologist, novel DNA sequences are now designed and built by undergraduate students in technical universities. Extreme Genetic Engineering, An Introduction to Synthetic Biology, is a new report from the Etc. Group. Hope Shand is their research director, and she's joined me on the phone from North Carolina. Good afternoon, Hope.
Good afternoon. Nice to be with you.
Now, how is synthetic biology different from genetic engineering, something we've been hearing about for quite a few years?
Well, to put it really simply, synthetic biology is kind of like genetic engineering on steroids. And in some ways, it simply amplifies the powers of genetic engineering. But whereas with genetic engineering, we're talking about transferring genes between species, synthetic biology, we are talking about really building life from scratch and doing that in the laboratory. And I think the other thing is that with synthetic biology, we're kind of seeing a quantum leap in the technological potential of manipulating biological materials. And you mentioned just a minute ago the DNA synthesis technology. Well, that's advancing extremely rapidly. It's becoming very cheap, and it's geographically dispersed. It's been possible to synthesize DNA for a long time, but back in 1973, it would have taken one scientist a whole year to make a length of DNA that was 11 base pairs long. And today, it would take minutes to do the same thing, and it would cost just a couple of $100.
Yes, I read in your report that there's this shift from reading and deciphering straight through to writing the stuff. Now, what new technologies have converged to make this leap possible?
Well, that's a really good question. And, you know, when you talk about synthetic biology, you kind of want to say, well, you know, what is this? Is this biotech? Is it biology? Is it nanotechnology, which happens at the level of atoms and molecules, or is it information technology? And really, the answer is that synthetic biology is all three of those things, that it's really inspired by the convergence of engineering and biology and computing. This technology is made so much more powerful because of those technologies coming together.
Now, we've talked about this advance in nanotechnology. Can you give us an idea of a couple of the major areas of research that Synbio people are actually working on?
Probably one of the most high-profile scientists in this arena is J. Craig Venter. He's the man who led the private effort to map the human genome. He made headlines 4 years ago when his team created the first synthetic virus from scratch. And he's pretty notorious for pushing the boundaries on the commercial exploitation of life in general. And in 2005, he founded a company called Synthetic Genomics, Inc., and they aim to commercialize synthetic biology applications. And what they're doing now is they're trying to create a minimal microbe in the laboratory. And what that is a very simplified bacteria that can survive with a minimal number of genes. And the reason they're trying to do that is that they want to use this minimal genome as a stripped-down chassis, and they want to build synthetic organisms in the laboratory, and they want to program the genetic pathways of those organisms to perform tasks, commercially useful tasks. And the one that Venter's working on has been called Mycoplasma Laboratorium. And if he succeeds, it's going to be the first fully synthetic living species ever created. He wants to program this organism to do things like produce ethanol or hydrogen for alternative fuel production. And, of course, that's very compelling. He also talks about using a synthetic organism to sequester carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that implies environmental release of a synthetic organism, which raises many, many biosafety issues. Let me give you another example. There's a team in Cambridge, Massachusetts at MIT that are working on what they call intentional biology, and they use a lot of metaphors from electronics and computing to describe their work. They talk about a living organism as a machine, and that it's made out of genetic circuits, and DNA is like software that can be hacked. And Drew Endes is one of the leaders at MIT in this field, and he talks about, you know, how biological engineers of the future are going to start with their laptops, not in the laboratory. And what they've done, what they're doing now, is they've started by inventing hundreds of discrete DNA modules that are something like electronic components. And the idea is to combine these DNA modules into more complex genetic circuits. And they call them biobricks, or standard genetic parts. And if it reminds you of Legos, those little toys that kids use to build things, that's the idea. That's the image they have in mind. And the idea is that each biobrick is a strand of DNA that's designed to perform one function. And it's compatible with other biobricks, so you can put these things together to make longer circuits. Then you drop it into a microbial host, like a E. coli or a yeast cell, and you see if it functions. And they actually have competitions to do this now with college students from all over the world. And the goal is to create artificial life forms out of biobricks.
Now, these are extraordinarily audacious technologies. What dangers do they present?
Well, I think probably the most obvious concern is that of bioweapons and the misuse of new organisms. Scientists have already reconstructed dangerous pathogens in the laboratory using synthetic DNA, and there have been two very, very famous examples. Researchers in New York recreated the poliovirus, and they did it using mail-order synthetic DNA. They just pasted together short strands of synthetic DNA, and they made a functional version of the poliovirus. And they did it to illustrate just how easy it was to construct a dangerous pathogen using mail-order parts. And then 2 years ago, another team of researchers announced that they had resurrected a highly lethal flu virus, the 1918 flu virus that killed 20 to 50 million people worldwide back in 1918 and 19. And that virus had been eradicated from Earth, but what they did was they recovered the viral RNA sequence from the tissues of flu victims who had been buried in permafrost, and they actually did manage to resurrect this virus, and the full genome of the 1918 flu virus is now published in public databases. So the potential to construct or reconstruct these virulent microorganisms is vastly enhanced with synthetic biology. And I want to stress that the threat here is not just this idea of bioterror, the intentional misuse of these dangerous pathogens, but also what Martin Rees calls bioerror, the idea that even very well-meaning scientists can make mistakes, or there can be accidents, and that they're not going to be able to ultimately control or contain living organisms.
Yes, it seems to me that we're dealing with a lot of unknowns here, that, you know, once viable organisms evolve, get out from the laboratory, they can evolve and mutate and change into all sorts of things.
That's exactly right. And even with genetic engineering, scientists and government regulators have been unable to control or contain living organisms.
Well, that's what I'm interested in. So what sort of regulatory environment exists now?
Well, there are the same regulations that would govern genetically engineered organisms, but unfortunately what we've seen so far is that the small number of synthetic biologists that are based in the United States have attempted to put forth proposals for self-regulation, and we think that that is the absolute wrong direction to go in. It's not sufficient to have a small group of scientists control this public discourse or determine what the regulatory framework should be. Too often what we see with the bid for self-regulation is a move to avoid greater government scrutiny or regulations, and that's the wrong approach.
I'm interested in when you're communicating these issues, which are very technical, to activists, I'm wondering what barriers you encounter, you know, in trying to communicate such issues around the world.
Well, I think what we've seen really is that people who have been interested in following the debate and controversies surrounding genetic engineering really have no problem understanding the issues of synthetic biology. Yes, some of it's technically complex, but people tend to get this immediately. And our staff recently, just last week, came back from the World Social Forum in Nairobi, where we did a number of workshops and talks on synthetic biology. And people get it immediately. They understand extreme genetic engineering. They understand why it's so important to have more information, to learn more about this, and why civil society needs to get together to develop and plan a response to the emergency of synthetic biology in the context of these wider converging technologies.
Well, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with me this afternoon. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
I've been talking with Hope Shand. Hope Shand is the research director of Etc. Group.
And that was Peter Royce in conversation with Hope Shand in February 2007. The report they were talking about is called Extreme Genetic Engineering. Peter was a very creative person, and he loved political actions that stepped outside of the tried and true. That's why he had so much fun talking with Wendy Peterson last year about an event organized by the Carnegie Community Action Project. Here is that conversation, recorded in February 2008.
The first annual Poverty Olympics takes place tomorrow at the Carnegie Theatre in the downtown East Side. Event organizers promise that these Olympics will also be fun, food, games, medals, and a brand new torch. Wendy Peterson is an organizer with the Poverty Olympics, and she's just joined me now in the studio. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning.
So who are Itchy, Chewy, and Creepy?
Everybody wants to know who Itchy, Chewy, and Creepy are. They're our official mascots of the Poverty Games, and I guess the mascots from the Vancouver Olympics better roll over, because ours are taking over, and maybe they'll go to real Olympic events too. We already went to City Hall with some of them. We've made stuffy toys out of, we've made a bed bug, a cockroach, and a rat. And we've also got people dressed up in those costumes. The Raise the Rates Coalition, that's organizing this event. Different people from different groups that are affiliated with the coalition made the costumes and the stuffy toys. And they're just hilarious. When we bring them out at the Carnegie Center, people just, they howl. And it's like bittersweet. I would say it's good for the soul. And it's the organizing of this whole event has been really, really good for us, because it gets us to laugh at, you Absolutely. Know. And it also has a really good message. And we know that we're going to get that message out with the Poverty Games.
Well, those are such appropriate mascots for the downtown East Side. Having been working down here for so many years, it's really extraordinary.
You bet.
And yes, they really fit. Now, so tell us, what are some of the Olympic Games that athletes will be competing in?
Well, we're going to have, one of them is the welfare hurdles. If the audience may not know that there's arbitrary rules to getting on and staying on welfare, and a lot of homelessness is caused by that, people not being able to get through those hurdles. So we actually have hurdles, and we have three different types of people who are going to try to get over these hurdles. So we also have the long jump over the bed bug infested mattress, and the mattress has got felt bed bugs on it with Velcro, so if you fall on the mattress, oh no, who's going to get stuck with bed bugs on them? There's also the poverty line high jump. And so there's educational element to this. Absolutely, people are going to learn what the poverty line is actually, and how far up above it is that people can't get over. I don't know if there's going to be many winners at our games.
Well, I was wondering about that.
You know what, the funny one that somebody right now is making We're going to do curling for the Olympic housing promises. And instead of a curling ball, we're going to make it out of Jello. And instead of brooms, we're going to have mops. So I don't know how far we're going to get to the target with the Jello curling balls.
Well, they say that it's not about winning. It's the process that counts.
Well, yeah. And maybe it's going to look real good, right? But then when you actually try to throw it, how far does it get? So this is high satire. It is going to be fun and educational. We also actually, for the last 3 months, artists from the Downtown East Side have been building a colossal mobile torch that's going to be lit, a poverty torch that's going to be lit to end until poverty ends, symbolically lit. And it's quite beautiful, and lots of hands went into making it, and it'll be unveiled at the Poverty Games. Mobile, meaning that we'll be able to use that throughout this year to as a prop. You know, if there's other Olympic events happening in the city, we can show up with our torch and a bit of educational piece.
Now, I hear that you've actually approached the International Olympic Committee to support these games. What was the consequence of that?
We did. Actually, we debated, should we ask them for funding, which would be really spoofy. And I think we ended up just asking them to pressure our governments. But I would have preferred to ask them for funding for it, because it really puts them on the spot, and then reporters can call them and, you know. We also sent invitation to VanOck to come as well. So we're hoping that reporters will pick that up and get their feedback on what they think. And I think our government should be embarrassed.
Yes, yeah, so
obviously.
Your approach there, are you angling to be part of the official games?
This is the first annual. So, well, maybe it will just happen to have to happen again on the third annual, if we have, which would be 2010. If we haven't solved poverty by then.
So, you know, you've described the poverty here as world class. You know, can you maybe give a sense to listeners what that actually looks like, what that means?
Sure. There's 2,000 people sleeping outside right now, probably higher. But that count will be done soon. That's in the city of Vancouver alone. There's 700 people in shelters on top of that. And even our local shelter here turns away 30, 40 people every night. A single person is living with $375 a month to pay for rent in Vancouver. I don't know about you, but how many places do you know of that you can pay for $375? Everybody's using the last little bit of food money that they've got from welfare, the extra $200. They're putting it into their rent. So they're in desperate survival mode. The cost of living is super expensive. And then what it does is people end up having to make really choices based on survival that are harmful to themselves, and it's also harmful to everybody.
So what brought you to actually make the connection there with the Olympics? Like, why use the Olympics as a vehicle?
Oh, the Olympics is the perfect vehicle because our governments are worried about being embarrassed internationally. They should be embarrassed. 1 in 4 children in British Columbia are living in poverty. Embarrassment to them. Also, people in the Downtown East Side are eating out of garbage cans. Embarrassment. So we're not doing anything special. We're just going to highlight something when we know, you know, during the Olympic Games, the global spotlight is going to be on Vancouver. Just another thing to add, every Olympic Games worldwide, every Olympics, every big event has a similar pattern of exaggerating the legacy and minimizing the losses. And that's happening in Vancouver big time.
So now you've produced an interesting graph about the costs of putting on the Olympics with compared to solving poverty. Maybe you could outline a couple of points from that. It's
The cost for 3,200 units of housing, raising welfare by 50%, and ending the barriers to getting on and staying on welfare is about $1.34 billion. Compare that to the surplus that the BC government had last year. Mm-hmm. 1 year alone, they had a $4.1 billion surplus. The federal government had a staggering $14 billion surplus. Why should we have to even hound them for housing? They canceled, both of the BC government and the federal government in the 90s, canceled their social housing programs, downloaded welfare to provinces. And just the graph is so, like, the how much it would cost to reduce poverty compared to the surplus is just mammoth.
Absolutely. It's astonishing, isn't
it? It's astonishing. And then also we've worked out the cost of the Olympics just to give folks a perspective. For example, the UBC ice hockey arena To build this Olympic venue, it'll be $47 million. Well, that would be 235 homes. The skating oval, $178 million, would be 890 housing units or homes. So just to show it that the money is there, even without taking away the Olympic money, even with our surpluses, we could still do all this. It's very doable.
Yeah, I think when you show figures like this, it really does make the case that it is a matter of political will. And of course, political will can be changed. So how can people get involved with this project? And
well, I think there's probably a contact on the website, the Poverty Olympics, and we're going to have a button there soon where you just press it and you go, you can write a letter instantly to the three levels of government plus the IOC in Vanok. And if people wanted to call me, I'd be happy to help plug people in. And my phone number is 604-839-0379. And maybe you could post that on the website, website for Red Eye.
Well, look, thanks very much for coming in and telling us about it. It sounds like a great project. I think it's going to be wonderfully successful.
One last funny thing tell you. Yesterday we unveiled our Poverty Olympics flag.
Absolutely, it's great.
It's got the gray background with the five Olympic rings, but the Olympic rings are made into handcuffs, and it says at the top of it, end poverty, it's not a game. And as we unveiled it, somebody made the joke, hey, we got to watch this flag really carefully. The city might try to steal it from us. So we're going to unveil our flag tomorrow, too. And it's going to be carried by two people who have been evicted recently, or are going to be evicted soon in the downtown east side from their places. So it's kind of symbolic that they're going to be carrying the Olympic flag.
It's a great flag, much better than the original.
I agree.
Certainly more reflective of Vancouver.
I agree.
As we experience
so maybe it. We can make a ginormous one of it. That would be really good for next year.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I could fly it on top of the Carnegie Center or something.
That's great. Well, thanks very much for coming and talking to me this morning.
Wendy Peterson and Peter Royce spoke about the Poverty Olympics in February 2008, and since that conversation, the Carnegie Community Action Project hosted a second Poverty Olympics. And you've been listening to a tribute to longtime host and Red Eye Collective member Peter Royce. Peter died on November 4th. If you'd like to read what friends have written about Peter, or share a memory of your own, you can go to rememberingpeterroyce.wordpress.com. You'll also find links there to a video of his memorial held at Rhizome Cafe last Sunday, and those links will be posted in a couple of weeks. In April next year, around the time of his birthday, there'll be a big party to celebrate Peter's life. We'll give you more details about that closer to the time.